So tonight's Dhamma talk is called Conditions for Wisdom. And this is based on a sutta found in what's called the Anguttara Nikaya. Anguttara means the numerical or the numbered discourses. And it's actually it's one of five books of how the Buddhist teachings have been organized, particularly in the Sri Lankan branch of Theravada, but how they've organized them has gone into all the other branches and is sort of the methodology and explanation that is used principally within the insight mindfulness community that I'm part of. So, and then this is like, there's a book of ones, a book of twos, a book of threes. There's like lists. It's like the Buddhist teachings, there's so many lists, right? And so they're just like, let's just organize them by the number. Because sometimes you'll be thinking, there were six something, but I can't quite remember what it is. But then you look up in the book of sixes and, oh, there it is, So it's a method. And not all of the, it's some of the things in there are smaller, briefer things. But this particular sutta caught my attention. I want to read a little bit of the sutta. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll read a little bit of it, and then we'll talk about conditions for wisdom. There are, O monks, these eight causes and conditions for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life when it has not been obtained, and for bringing about the increase, maturation, and fulfillment by development of the wisdom that has already been obtained. In other words, here's things you can do to increase your wisdom being the result of insight. Okay. And here's an explanation of the first one. Here, a monk lives in dependence on the teacher, or on a certain fellow monk in the position of a teacher, and he has set up towards him a keen sense of shame and moral dread, and regards him with affection and respect. This is the first cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. And then he goes on listing the others. And I'm just going to read the list, and then I'm going to sort of break it down one by one. So this one, finding a teacher, number one. And asking the teacher questions about the Dhamma. Words, be curious, right? Withdrawing to contemplate the Dhamma. Once you've absorbed the teachings, then you need to sort of stew in them for a little while. Living a life of virtue. We've talked about that a lot. Memorizing and penetrating the teachings. In other words, go deeper. And memorizing, I'll talk about that a little bit too. Energetic, steadfast, and strong. In other words, now you got to be really serious. You can't just sort of be, well, I'll take a little bit of this, a bit of that. This one. Don't talk frivolously. Focus is always on the Dhamma and practice. And the eighth one is practice noting the five aggregates. So once you've accomplished the first seven, then you're ready to get serious, which is the teachings, the practice of the five aggregates. So let's look at these. This is a, and I have a huge pile of books I want to read bits and pieces from here. This is from Joseph Goldstein. So the first one here is that you find a teacher. Okay. And this is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation. Dharma practice takes us to the edge of what is known. Mostly in our life, we create for ourselves a domain of comfort, where everything is in place and we know where we stand. Often our mind builds strong defenses to maintain reassuring stability in our inner realm. But this security also limits us to the familiar, to the easily recognized. There are worlds of experience and ways of being that lie beyond the habits of our conditioning. Do we have the courage of heart and spirit to explore the unknown? A teacher, a guide, a spiritual friend can be an inestimable help on the path. Such a person can reveal what is hidden, point out the path and inspire our highest aspirations. As we pass the boundaries of familiarity, we experience suffering and happiness in new and unexpected ways. Sometimes suffering spurs our effort to be free. Other times we simply become mired in patterns of suffering, unable to find our way out. Happiness can trap us even more. There are many nice resting places along the spiritual path. We begin to feel more peaceful, more in harmony, better adjusted, and more accepting. We relate better to others. Our life gets easier, and we may decide to settle into this place of ease for a nice, long rest. A good teacher knows when a student is stuck, either in suffering or in conditioned kind of happiness. Employing a variety of skillful means, the teacher uses everything as fuel for the fire of awakening. At times we need encouragement and loving support. At other times, perhaps a fierce wake-up call. I've certainly had both of those in my experience. And he goes on. One area of difficulty that can arise in the student-teacher relationship is confusion between power and authority. In all domains of life, we encounter people who have more understanding than we do about certain things. Acknowledging that difference opens us to learning from such people. It helps us keep a beginner's mind. But acknowledging someone's understanding in a particular area should not be confused with conferring power. We can welcome guidance, instruction, and inspiration without abandoning our own inner moral sense. Problems related to power may come from both sides. Teachers may have some genuine level of realization, but may not yet be fully liberated, and so at many times they may act from places of ignorance. Students may be too willing to surrender their own powers of discriminating wisdom in the name of spiritual humility. We often mistakenly assume that because someone has genuine understanding in one particular area, this mastery necessarily extends to all other areas of life. That may be or may not be true. So he's pointing to actually a big issue here. Number one, it is good to find someone you can learn from. Absolutely. I've gone through the process with a couple of different teachers at various times in my life. Three or four times, actually. and it's always been very fruitful for me. But as he's pointing out, there's this danger that we get into with teacher-student connection, where we think, if we're not careful, oh, that's what the teacher says I should do, so that's what I should do. Because often the teacher might say something he thinks he or she thinks you should do for misguided reasons of their own. There are many sad examples of this in the quote spiritual culture that we're a part of that I've seen over the years, including one of my teachers back in the day, unfortunately. And so we have to sort of be mindful that yes, we're learning from these people. Yes, they like, wow, they're really amazing. But they're still human beings. And we don't give in to them automatically. Though at times, sometimes it's like, okay, that's what the teacher said I should do, so I should do that. I remember fairly early on in my practice time, I was sort of, well, to be honest, sort of wishy-washy about metta practice. Metta was like, you know, that sort of airy-fairy, hippy-dippy stuff. You know, I was a serious meditator. I did Vipassana. You know, I was like... But I was practicing with this teacher, and I was really, really inspired by his Dharma talks and his teaching. And at one point, and several times other teachers who I respected, I mean, like Joseph, among others, said to me, you know, you really should get serious about metta. And I sort of go, yeah, 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 in my mind, and yes, sir. And I would ignore him, you know. then, this teacher just said, at one time in my life, I did a 3-month metta retreat. And I was going, this guy, this is my teacher guy, my most recent teacher guy, my serious intellectual giant teacher, did 3 months of metta. And I was like, really rocked by this. And then he said, and after that 3-month retreat, my only practice for the next year and a half was metta. I went, oh, this is actually kind of important, isn't it? And actually, then the next retreat I went on, I did a month of metta. My first time I did a full month of metta. I've done it since then a couple of times. And it's like it changed my whole view of practice and metta and everything. It was like, oh. So just like being poked in a sense like that, or letting myself be poked, following that example made a big difference in my practice. But there's lots of examples of people who sort of surrender. There is this in some traditions, this idea that you're supposed to surrender to the teacher. And this causes lots of difficulty because teacher may not, if the teacher was a totally enlightened being, that might be okay. But most teachers these days aren't. There's like me, they're sort of struggling along trying to figure it out themselves. And so we have to be very careful about that. In this tradition, in the Theravada tradition, we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, right? In many other traditions, including many Buddhist traditions, you take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and the Guru, the teacher. Having been there myself, having surrendered to a guru back in the day and had some problems based on that, you have to be really careful when you try to think of things in that context. It was very powerful in some ways, it sort of woke me up, but at the same time, it wasn't always useful, skillful. And it took me a while to see that. So just this is I'm just waving the yellow warning flag here, I suppose. And the reason I like this particular tradition, and one reason this tradition attracted me so much initially, back there 20-odd years ago when I came to this form, was it didn't have that idea of guru at all. In fact, it was actively discouraged. People like Joseph could turn themselves into a guru and everybody would bow down to him, he would be horrified. He would be horrified if you bowed down to him. I was standing in the doing, there's a line, at the ashram, at the retreat in Barre, Massachusetts. I was standing in line to do my dishes after a meal. And Joseph came up and stood right behind me. Like Joseph, he's just a regular guy. He's going to stand in line to do his dishes like anybody else. And I sort of like, I turned to him and I was like stunned he was there. And I just sort of motioned that I would take his plate. And he gave me his plate. And I thought, oh my God, I got Joseph's plate. It was so wonderful. And then he said thank you and went away. And so that's okay. It was like a mark of respect. You shouldn't be standing in line to do your dishes. I can take care of that for you. A little thing I can do, and that's fine. So just be aware that there are lines we have to be careful of in this area, that you don't think anyone is the answer to all your questions. And as I have done, you go through cycles with teachers where you find a teacher who sort of resonates. The way they speak, what they speak about, how they teach, just feels right for you. And that's great. And that's what you need. You need to find someone who you connect with in that way. It somehow, at the level of heart, as much as at the level of mind, you feel a connection. But don't for one second think that that's going to be that way forever. For one thing, teachers die. That's just a natural. Teachers come and go like everybody else. Or, and else, you know, and just like you change. You develop a certain point in your practice, and then, you know, you whatever was going on with that particular teacher, all of a sudden it doesn't gel anymore. And you have to go, oh, it's okay, time to find someone else. And that can also be quite skillful at times. It isn't like you're not making the lifelong commitment. If you were a monastic and took monastic vows, that might be the case. You're taking a lifelong commitment to be a monastic within a certain organization or what or retreat or whatever. But we're not, we're householders. We live in the world. Things change. Our lives change. What we need changes. So that's the last thing I want to say about the teacher anyhow. Yeah. So then that was the first condition of wisdom. But you have to find someone. You have to find some way of connecting more deeply to the practice, to the teachings. Then asking the teacher questions about the Dhamma. So we need to use our intellect. We don't just take the teachings as dogma, as absolute truth. Well, that's what the teacher said, so it must be true. Question everything. Everything. Without hesitation, question everything you hear from the teachings. It's don't be afraid to challenge the teacher or the teachings. You know, who say, yes, but what about sometimes that's when you really learn things, and the yes, but moments. Because then, you know, you can get that yes, but moment put to rest. If the teacher just can explain something, and you go, oh, okay. I see, because they might see it from a deeper place than you're seeing it from. So it's really can be really skillful to ask questions, to question everything. You know, there's this in the Kalama Sutta. You know, someone asked the Buddha, you know, how do you know what's right, basically? Because all these different people were coming and teaching to the Kalamas, which is a village in India at the time. And he went through this long list of like, you know, don't just trust the teacher, don't base it on the scriptures, don't base it on, you know, he went through this long list. And the last thing he said basically was, and don't believe a word I'm saying until you know it's true for yourself. Till you experience it, don't believe it. You might want to suspend your disbelief. Sometimes we need to do that sometimes with some of the teachings. But to suspend our disbelief, which means, well, I'm not sure, but this seems to be what everybody's saying and what the teachings say and what the what the Buddha said. So I don't know this for a fact, but at least I can not reject it out of hand. It's just because I don't understand it right now doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means maybe I'm not haven't figured it out yet. I haven't got that experiential moment where I go ah. So, withdrawing to contemplate the Dhamma. This is number three. So you've and remember, this is a teaching for monastics, but also it's also I think very much useful in our life to think of it in this way. I want to just read a couple of little bits of things from the Majjhima Nikaya here. And basically, the Buddha is describing what it means to withdraw. Okay, just within this, in the context of monastics, right? What more is to be done? Here, a bhikkhu resorts to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. So he's saying, notice these were all out in nature, which in Buddhist time, most of India was still nature right now. It'd be harder to find places like this now, I suspect. But what he's basically pointing to is the need to sort of seclude yourself somewhat from time to time to allow yourself to totally concentrate on the teachings, on the practice. This is what retreat is about. This is why in this Western householder model that we now have, this is what we're doing. It's a bit more luxurious than the root of a tree or a cave, but it's like we need to, they're pretty simple. If you've ever been on a retreat, you'll know the places where there are retreats like plain, simple food, often in beautiful places in nature, where you can, if you want to, go sit at the root of a tree for a while. So we need to be aware that we need this from time to time to step back from our busy householder lives and have this space for doing something more contemplative and still. And this, here's the Buddha actually describing his own seclusion. Such was my seclusion, Sariputta, that I would plunge into some forest and dwell there. And when I saw a cowherd or a shepherd or someone gathering grass or sticks or a woodsman, I would flee from grove to grove, from thicket to thicket, from hollow to hollow, from hillock to hillock. Why was that? So that they should not see me or I see them. Just as the forest red deer, on seeing human beings, flees from grove to grove, from thicket to thicket. Such was my seclusion. So he's describing how he achieved seclusion by consciously avoiding contact with people. This is partly because often in people who are monastics, if they came across someone who was not a monastic, a householder came across, the householder would want to talk to them and ask them questions. And that would, he didn't want to have to deal with that. He went, I'm just going to go, I want to be away from everything for a while. So, and then I actually have a little piece of poetry here that also talks to this really well. This is from Naomi Shihab Nye's a collection of poems called Words Under the Words. And I just love this poem so much. It's called The Art of Disappearing. When they say, "Don't I know you?" say no. When they invite you to a party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem. Greasy sausage balls on a paper plate. Then reply. If they say, "We should get together," say why. It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees, the monastery bell at twilight. Tell them you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognizes you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time. It's just pure Dhamma in poetry form. So that's the third of these conditions for wisdom, finding a teacher, asking the teacher questions about the Dhamma, and then literally going into seclusion, going to having time when you can actually absorb the teachings by going deeper and having space in seclusion where that's all you're paying attention to. You're stepping back from your busy life in the world for some period of time, whether that's for, you can do this. Some people going away for a long retreat just isn't possible for your life. But you could say, okay, on Sunday morning, I'm going to get up. I'm going to make my coffee, of course. Then I'm going to do my sitting practice. Then I'll make a very simple little breakfast. I'll go for a silent walk around the neighborhood. Then I'll come back and I'll sit again. Then I might do some simple walking practice in my house or on my back porch. And then I'll sit again. Now it's noon. You just had a little retreat. That would be a great thing to do. So there's no excuse not to retreat. I mean, to do that, you might have to sort of tell the people who think you should always be available on the phone. I'm turning my phone off. Don't panic. I'll turn it back on afternoon. I mean, there are people who have lives like that for a variety of reasons. But it's like you can always take a space where you go have a little bit more time than just a sitting practice once a day to go a little deeper. Really important. Number four is living a life of virtue. I've spoken a lot about this over time. I'm not going to talk about this anymore, other than the importance of living a life of virtue is that when you don't, then you have to deal with all the emotional baggage that arises when you've done something unskillful, and then you feel guilty and you feel bad. No, I shouldn't have done that. And then you tell a whole story about how I should have done it differently. It just roils up the mind, and that makes it difficult to practice. It's as simple as that. So it isn't like living a life of virtue is a virtue in and of itself. It's you live a life of virtue so your mind stays still. So you don't have that whirling mind about, oh, I shouldn't have done that all the time. Memorizing and penetrating the teachings. So this is something that is very specific to the Buddhist time and also I think useful in our current time. But traditionally, the Sangha of the monastics who were associated with the Buddha, each of them had, as part of their practice, memorizing a certain part of the teachings. Because the teachings were totally oral. They weren't written down at all. And so the monastic community as a whole maintained the teachings of the Buddha through memorization. There are traditions today that basically the teacher will say, okay, memorize this teaching. And when you've got it memorized and you can say it back to me perfectly clearly, then I'll explain it to you. Because the process of memorizing in and of itself stimulates something where we connect to the teaching somehow. So even today, I think sometimes memorizing the teachings might be a really interesting thing. The teachings were eventually written down a couple of hundred years after the Buddha passed, where this king in North India, North India was a huge Buddhist community at this point, basically said, "All right, all you monastics, you're all going to come, and one at a time, you're going to recite your portion." And it turned into the huge collection of Dhamma teachings that are still available to us today, lucky us. But they all actually got written down about 200 years after the Buddha had passed. But as I said, I think memorizing is a really powerful tool in and of itself. I'd had this habit of memorizing things back in a totally different tradition where we had these long Sanskrit songs and chants we had to memorize. So I wasn't good at memorizing anyway. But it was like so, it was habit in some sense. So the first time I went on retreat in this tradition, I went for a month-long retreat. We were chanting at the end of every day, we're chanting this thing called the sharing of blessings, an aspiration. And it just moved me somehow. I was having a really difficult time. I was like freaking out. Oh my God, I'm here for a month. How could I have been so crazy to come here and think I could do this? I mean, it was like my mind was going like this, up and down, all the time. at the same time, I was trying to be very diligent in actually following the form and, going to all the sits and doing all the walking and all those sorts of things. But I decided to memorize the sharing of blessings because I was like, that's part of how I am, I suppose. But also, just like, it seemed like, oh, this is an important thing. They do it every day. It's something I can memorize and sort of give myself something useful to do. So as I was going for my walks during the day and that sort of thing, I was just memorizing sections of it. The last section, which is six lines, is basically a reaffirmation of refuge. And it goes like this. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. So I was in the midst of memorizing this particular section. And at the same time, as I said, my mind was total chaos most of the time. I was really like questioning being there and not, questioning the teachers and questioning the teachings and, things like, oh, I don't know how these people think they can possibly teach. I wouldn't let them organize a cat fight. I mean, really just like extreme agitation and restlessness. But I was chanting this over and over again as I was walking around, sitting in the Dhamma hall for a practice. And of course, because I've been doing this so much, there it comes. I'm sitting there trying to, pay attention to my breath, and here's this chant going in my head instead. And then it struck me that what were just words in my head were really true. I was in this place of this fantastic place with these amazing teachers who were senior teachers in this lineage. And I was like so safe. I was really in a place of total refuge with these people. And it was like, oh. And it just like changed. At that point, the whole retreat changed. The next 2.5 weeks were like totally different than the first week and a half. Because, only because I'd been memorizing the teachings. And memorizing the teachings made them real some way. So, anyhow, it's interesting to think about the teachings in that way. Whether you memorize some of the chants or you memorize, I was the same when I started practicing metta, I memorized the Metta Sutta as well. Everybody finds if this appeals to you, it's the kind of thing you can do where you sort of get connected with the teachings in a different way. So number six, energetic, steadfast, and strong. So put energy into the practice. Don't think anything happens magically by itself. It's like if you don't actually study and be diligent in your practice, nothing's going to happen. What a surprise. It's just like, you decide you want to be a concert pianist. And so if you just sort of sit and look at the piano and say, oh, that's a piano, yep. I can see how those keys work. You understand the mechanism, but you don't actually practice ever. Well, nothing's going to happen. This is no different. This practice is no different. You're trying to become a concert meditator. That's a funny image, but it's like, you see what I'm getting at. We're trying to, and to do that, we have to take the practice really seriously and really sort of be diligent about our practice. Ah, yes, another little tidbit of Joseph here. And he's talking about how sometimes being diligent, like I just described, the practice starts to seem sort of dry. Oh, I just sat again. Yep, now I'm going to do some walking practice. Now, I'm going to memorize this sutta, blah, blah, blah. It just doesn't. And part of our problem with that, two issues. One is we get to the place where, God, this is really boring. Keep doing the same thing over and over again. It's so boring, this practice. I've been there, so I understand this one. When I went to one of my teachers early on in my practice again and said, God, this practice is so boring. I said, you're just not paying enough attention. And it was true. My practice had become sort of on the surface. I was following the form, but I really wasn't putting much energy into it. I'd gotten really good at imitating the form. But I wasn't really bearing down. I wasn't being diligent and energetic. I wasn't paying enough attention. And the other thing is, and this is really true in our sort of Western culture, especially the, what I'll call the spiritual culture, the world of, that came out of the hippie world into today's world of lots of different things going on that can be hippie-ish, I suppose. Anyhow. And he's talking here, Joseph's talking about spontaneity in practice. Because what happens is we think, no, I don't need to practice. I just want to be spontaneous. And everything will just come to me through my spontaneousness, right? Here's Joseph's response to that idea, which I think is great. We often have an idea that unconsidered, impromptu behavior is spontaneous, and we consider it something pure. But is it? It may be just acting as a slave to conditioning. Is it some great, noble, spontaneous, pure heart creating such actions? Occasionally it may be, but it could just as well be the habit of formations of desire, greed, anger, fear, and confusion, causing us to act without reflection. We call that spontaneous. How many times have you found yourself in the middle of doing something before you know you've even started it? That's not spontaneity, it's mechanical behavior, like sleepwalking. A truer spontaneity reveals itself very remarkably in the practice. This is the intrinsic spontaneity of all phenomena, of the Dhamma, of the whole process of life. When we establish a certain momentum of energy, mindfulness, and concentration, we begin to experience the smooth and rapid flow of all appearances arising and passing by themselves. We are sitting in meditation and a thought comes. Did we invite the thought? Probably not. Sometimes we do, but more often thoughts just arise uninvited. Sensations arise. Sounds appear. The more we settle into this process of who we are, this process of the mind and body, the greater is our appreciation for the mystery of it all. There is awesome grace in this true rhythm of life. Here is an incredible song of the elements singing themselves. This is far deeper sense of spontaneity, the essence of who we are. How different it is from mechanical conditioned behavior. So in this sense, mindfulness is actually the key to spontaneity. Mindfulness is the vehicle through which we can open to a continuous, spontaneous arising and passing of all phenomena. At the same time, this is the flip side of this thing, is we've got to be careful that we don't sort of over-effort. We don't sort of start sitting and going, my mind's going to be still it kills me. It's like I'm just gonna force it into it. Because that then we're gonna first of all, it takes a lot of energy to do that, and it very wears you down pretty quickly if you keep doing it over and over again. And then what happens at a certain point, because you're pushing so hard, you've lost any sense of spontaneity. You've just lost any sense of anything other than, sure, I can do this because I'm powerful, and I can do this because I'm strong, and blah, blah, blah. And you just wear yourself out, and nothing happens. In fact, probably what happens is at a certain point you go, oh, God, this isn't working. And then you leave the practice completely. I've seen this happen several times with people I know, where like they were determined, but they were just not accepting of the fact that things take time and you have to sort of be a little gentle with yourself. You can't just force it. So this, how much energy, how much effort is a tricky balance in this practice, and we have to be aware that we have to find that balance. And it might be different from day to day, even. Sitting period to the sitting period. So we have to be mindful of not forcing things. Pushing because I want something, which often when we get into this mind space, it's out of desire. I want something to happen, and it's going to happen now. This is like desire in a sometimes not so subtle form, even, but it is desire nonetheless. And now you're just getting caught in desire. You're getting caught in desire for some amazing experience or something that happened before and I want it to happen again, or something I read about in a book, or like my friend told me, or like something should be happening that's like amazing. Yeah, sometimes it is. A lot of times it's so sad. Just do the practice and keep mindful of it as we do it. Yeah. Don't talk frivolously. This is number 7 on this list of things that lead to wisdom. Don't talk frivolously. Focus is always on Dhamma and practice. Well, this is remember a teaching to monastics. So to the monastics, this is a very correct instruction. For us, it's more as householders, there's still a lot of times when what we're doing is pretty frivolous if we're not careful. We're just sort of hanging out. And part of that is we have social obligations in the world. People we work with, our family, or we have to sort of be a little frivolous, perhaps. We can't, go hang out with our family or our co-workers for at some event and go, let's talk about the Dhamma. Still look at you like, oh God, that whoever your name is, there they are going on about that Dhamma stuff again. Why can't they just talk about football like the rest of us or whatever, So you can't go there. And we have to understand that we're social beings and we have to maintain social relationships. But we can start making wise choices about how much of that we do. I just went to visit my family up in Canada for 4 days. Perfect amount of time, 4 days. I mean, they're wonderful people. I really love them. But when I even me being a Buddhist, it's like they have running jokes about it. Okay, I mean, and that's okay. And they and they're wonderful people, and they're really generous and kind, and all that sort of stuff. They just don't get it, and that's fine. So I hang out, and we talked about hockey. Canadians, I got to talk about hockey, right? And we talked about family things and what this nephew was doing. And the guy caught up on all the nieces and nephews were doing, and that sort of stuff. What our favorite TV program is these days, And this is like being a human being and connected, staying connected to family and friends, and that this is a normal, natural thing to do. All I have to do is say, maybe I want to do that less and have more time to pay attention to more important things. Less frivolous, more serious. And once again, a tricky balance. And we have to all find that for ourselves. Number 8. He practices noting the five aggregates. So all the rest of this, all these other things, I think we're basically just preparing our mind to be still enough that we can absorb the teachings about the five aggregates, which is the Buddhist way, the primary way in the Buddhist teachings to try and make us aware of the truth of not self, of this, that we're not in any way separate. In the Samyutta Nikaya, you know, the collected discourses, this is the biggest section in the Samyutta Nikaya. It's 159 suttas on the five skandhas, right? The five aggregates. It's more than anything else by far. And I find it interesting that, because the rest of these things are like, oh, how we live our lives in the world, and, you know, and I was saying, oh, but now pay attention to this. This is like where this list ended. This is, he was saying, okay, now you're ready to start to really tune into. So, I mean, remember the five aggregates are just any material thing, then Vedana, feeling tone, the mental formation of feeling tone, perception, the process of experiencing something and then being able to label it, hearing a sound and being able to go, oh, that's a blue jay. Because we know we have this catalog of sounds in our mind, in our memory, and we know that sound. And then what's generally called mental formations, so which we use those words instead of thoughts, because thoughts are just one form of mental formation. There's moods and emotions and all kinds of other stuff that goes on. Perception and Vedana are mental formations, and they're consciously separated out in this list. Because they are totally pervasive. Every moment, every time we experience anything, Vedana arises and then perception arises. And then we start mental formation, now we start thinking about it and comparing it to other things. And then the fifth of these is consciousness, the actual process that envelops these other four, in a sense. And the reason this is so important is that when we start to really look at everything we're experiencing all the time, without exception, when we start to really look at it, that's why you see the Buddha says to actually pay attention by noting, like you can actually note which of the five skandhas, whatever you're experiencing, falls into at this point. You keep seeing that there's nothing solid at all. Everything's always changing. And then there's no solid self there at all. We just described everything, but there's no self there. There's nothing we can point to in this list of five categories. Remember, they call this the five aggregates, the five skandhas. Skandha literally translates as heaps. So these five heaps of experience. There's no self in any of these. It's just stuff arising and passing. Constantly arising and passing. Without exception. So that's why he puts so much emphasis on this. Because this is the way when we... And we can all sort of take this in intellectually and go, yeah, okay. Or at least, hopefully, suspend your disbelief that what I just said is true. We can all do that. But we eventually start to experience in our practice that that's all that's ever happening. Things are arising, they're there for a while, and they're gone. And that leads us to see there's nothing solid there. Which leads us to see, well, if there's nothing solid, that means there's no self that's there either. The self seems in our imagining that it's something solid. And it's not, it's totally just an idea that we have. It's just another thought form. It's a subtle one, a difficult one to let go of. Kind of scary to let go of. But that's all it is. So we have this incredible list, right? Finding a teacher, asking the teacher questions about the Dhamma, withdrawing to contemplate, taking time to sort of go deeper, living a life of virtue, memorizing and penetrating the teachings. So memorizing it was a way of getting deeper into them by, that's why the penetrating is there. It's like once you memorize something, it's how it just comes alive in a way that it doesn't when you just sort of know it's there. It forces you to go deeper into the teaching, into the meaning. Being energetic, steadfast, not talking frivolously, not frittering away too much time. We all fritter, I mean, some of them. Give me a good YouTube video once in a while every day. Entertain myself sometimes. And then practice. In particular, paying attention in this particular sutta, they put a lot of emphasis on the five aggregates of thinking. That's how we create the conditions for wisdom. Which is, remember what this was called, conditions. We're creating the conditions such that when we get to that last step and we start to really see what's happening, wisdom, insight into the true nature of things, that's what wisdom means in this tradition, insight into the true nature of everything pops into our mind, becomes clear at some not rational, not mental, not figured it out way, but like some experiential interior way. Want to finish this. I came across this a while ago. I might have read it to you all once before, but this is another one of those poems I just really love. This is please excuse my pronunciations, Wisława Szymborska, who was a poet, a Polish poet who won the Nobel Prize for Literature back 50, 20 years ago. And she's brilliant. And this particular poem sort of points to some sense of what I've been talking about. Just what she's talking about is how we think we know everything. We think we see things clearly. But that's only because we don't look at it from enough points of view. It's called view with a grain of sand. We call it a grain of sand, but it calls itself neither grain nor sand. It does fine without a name, whether general, particular, permanent, passing, incorrect, or apt. Our glance, our touch means nothing to it. It doesn't feel itself seen and touched. And that it fell on the windowsill is only our experience, not its. For it is no different from falling on anything else, with no assurance that it has finished falling, or that it is falling still. The window has a wonderful view of a lake, but the view doesn't view itself. It exists in this world, colorless, shapeless, soundless, odorless, painless. The lake's floor lists exists floorlessly, and the shore exists shorelessly. Its water feels neither wet nor dry, and its waves of themselves are neither singular nor plural. They splash deaf to their own noise on pebbles neither small nor large. And all this beneath a sky by nature skyless, in which the sun sets without setting at all and hides without hiding behind an unminding cloud. The wind ruffles it, its only reason being that it blows. A second passes, a second, a third, but They are 3 seconds only for us. Time is passed like a courier with urgent news, but that's just our simile. The character is invented. His haste is make-believe. His news, inhuman. It makes you pause and realize how much we live in the world of conception. How we think we see things, but all we're seeing is our conceptions of them, as opposed to them just being.